Hello, everyone, and welcome to Celebrating Cinema, a podcast for the love of cinema. I'm your host, Laura Romans, and I'm here with our producer, Elliot Bloom.
What's good?
Before we begin, I'd love to share some cool things going on in the coming weeks here at Lab 111 in Amsterdam. See Edward Yang's classic, Yi Yi, multiple times a day for its 25th anniversary re-release. Are you in the mood for love? On the 27th of September, we are playing Cupid and hosting a singles mingling night. Grab a drink at the bar, play movie-related games, and take your match to one of the specially selected date movies. Also, make sure to get a ticket to our next Celebrating Cinema Film Club, where I'll be introducing one of my personal favorites, Challengers, to coincide with our upcoming episode about Desire. But first, Elliot, what have you been watching?
Oh, good question. You know what I saw, actually, finally? I saw The Naked Gun.
The original, the OG.
No. The new Naked Gun.
With
Liam Neeson.
What did you think?
I loved it.
Amazing. Yeah, are you a fan of the originals?
I think I watched the first original and I think didn't age super well. So I think I was watching it at a time where I was like, these jokes aren't really landing with me.
Right.
But I enjoyed like the premise of it. Mm-hmm. But this, oh my gosh.
Like, it's great.
It really like, it's on such a thin line between being too much, going completely over the top and losing you. But it doesn't do that. And I think just how absurd it is amazing. And I think to have Liam Neeson, the guy who's probably like the most serious action man
you can have. The best straight man.
Yeah. So yeah, I couldn't stop laughing the whole time. And you go to not for the story or for the plot, but just for all the ridiculous gags.
It's truly a giggle a minute.
Yeah.
I went to see it at like 10 a.m. the day it came out. And it was pretty packed, I had to say. Yeah. Like, there were a lot of, like, boomer men, which I thought was fun. Because, like, obviously the originals are very much dad movies, I'd say.
Yeah.
But yeah, I wasn't expecting it to be this funny. Because it is directed by Akiva Schaffer from The Lonely Island. Anything The Lonely Island does is exactly up my alley, humor-wise. And yeah, this was great. It's so dumb.
It is so dumb. What have you been watching recently?
The other day at home, I had a bit of like a hangover day. And I was like, I want to watch something that's like a little dumb. And then I was looking at my watch list and I found Strange Days by Kathryn Bigelow.
Oh, yeah.
Have you seen it?
No, I haven't. Tell me.
It's wild. It's Ralph Fiennes, Angela Bassett, directed by Kathryn Bigelow, written by James Cameron.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm. Pre-Titanic, because it's 95.
This doesn't scream, though, like hangover film. Kathryn Bigelow films are very into, the few that I've seen.
It's goofy. It's basically like a Black Mirror episode.
Okay.
It was in the height of mini-disc technology, Elliot. Yeah. I don't know if you remember mini-disc.
Yeah.
Okay,
just about.
Just about. On the day you were born, we got rid of mini-discs. So it's like mini-disc technology, and you have this kind of like octopus type style device on your head and it records like virtual reality. Yeah. It records like through your eyes what you're doing. And this guy is like a dealer in these tapes because doing that activity is like drugs, you know, and everyone like looks down on it. It's like, oh, you're a, what do they call it? Like a wire head or something. They're like, they like look down on people who do this as a drug. And then he gets a tape and there's a murder on it. It's like a snuff film. And he's like, we have to figure out because it's like someone he knows. And there's a million characters, too many characters,
A
million characters. And they all have weird hair. And it's in 95 set in 99, which is hilarious because it's like futuristic in a way that 95 thought 99 would be. I thought it was interesting that a lot of the themes are still relevant, you know, thoughts on crime, racism and things like that.
It sounds also a bit camp.
It's incredibly camp. Yeah. There's something about the acting style. I was saying to my partner, like, there's something about the acting style that is kind of like almost like that theatrical style that we loved in the 90s that was kind of like the Baz Luhrmann thing where everything is kind of overplayed. And sometimes, like, they walk really fast. Or it's this really goofy style. I don't know what to call that style. Also, worth tuning into before Ralph Fiennes trying to do an American accent. That man is so British that
he can do a lot, but not an American accent.
He can do a lot. American accent, not one of them. I was constantly like, where is he supposed to be from? But yeah, I highly recommend it. It's a great watch. It's kind of, there's a lot of like boobs and a lot of like a very graphic, like, violence in a way that it's kind of like, maybe Kathryn Bigelow back in that time was a bit of a pick me girl.
Yeah.
You know, because I kept saying, like, I can't believe this was directed by a woman, but yeah. It's a fun watch.
She has a new film coming out. It's kind of like Doctor Strangelove. It's all about in the setting of a nuclear war room, basically, and what happens if the nuclear bomb drops off.
Damn.
So I'm quite excited for that. I know.
Just going back to dark shit. So, Yi already mentioned it in the intro. It's the 25th anniversary, and the film follows the John family. It's a middle-class family living in Taipei over the course of 1 year. At the center of it, we have NJ, the patriarch, a businessman, with his wife and two kids. His brother-in-law gets married, and that day sets off several crises, as the grandma gets a stroke, and NJ runs into his first love from childhood. In the months following, NJ's wife struggles with the meaning of life, and the kids are facing their own struggles. NJ's dealing with his past, and here's a clip.
Why are we afraid of the first time? Every day in life is a first time. Every morning is new. We never live the same day twice. We never afraid of getting up every morning. Why?
I didn't see it until yesterday.
First time ever.
First time ever. Because it's always on like the Letterboxd 100 best movies you have to see. And the New York Times, like best movies of the 21st century. And I was like, I have to see it, but I'm going to wait till it comes to the big screen because I knew I could always rely on trusty old lab to bring it back. So I was really happy that I got to see it on the big screen because it's a long movie.
Yeah.
It's hitting on 3 hours, I think. But I thought it was amazing. I thought it was incredible.
It was also my first time watching it. I was expecting something big, but probably not something to this extent. Mm-hmm. And I really came out of it, felt like I had changed in some way.
Yeah.
Because of what you watch. And I watched it about a week ago now. I've been trying to find the words to sort of describe what it is. But I think it's sort of a recognition of how you see all these different lives and it's set up between family generations. And the grandmother she has a stroke and is slowly dying, let's say, mm-hmm. and it's kind of creating like a circle of life with all the three different generations. And you sort of begin to realize over time how much more connected they are in the experiences they're having and sort of the repetition of what they're experiencing. Yeah. So the daughter is experiencing what the father had experienced and is sort of reminiscent or nostalgic.
Yeah,
for.
Like the first love kind of thing. Yeah. And it just does this beautiful thing where it kind of overlays the things happening. I think it's funny that you just used the word big, that it was big to you, because it's a big thing about big events, but it's mostly about small.
Yeah.
It's about these little moments. And I just got out of the movie yesterday and someone went, how was it? I was like, oh, it's just about life stuff. It's like, what is it about? I don't know. It's life stuff. It's like these like conversations and the silences and the regrets and the what if I didn't make the right choice? What if everything could have been different? Would it have been better?
Yeah.
Probably not. Like, I really love those kinds of movies that just kind of like sit with the characters doing their everyday stuff. The grandmother kind of turns into like a confession booth.
Yeah.
Because she has a stroke and the doctors say like, you have to keep talking to her because that might like stimulate her brain.
She's like a mirror to their lives.
Yeah. So like one by one, everyone sits down with the grandma and kind of does like confession to her. Like, man, I'm really thinking like if my life had turned out this way, or man, what do I do with my first boyfriend? Or it's this beautiful through line of people sitting down with grandma who's in a coma. And there's also this adorable little kid. I think the cutest little kid I've ever seen in film.
Yeah.
Number one cute kid. And the movie's also kind of dotted with him just being a curious little boy and asking his dad all these like insanely profound questions about like, why do you only see half of life? Because you can only see what's in front of you and never what's behind you. And then the dad kind of goes like, oh, well, maybe you should use your camera. And he just starts seeing the world through this camera and capturing all these little things. And I thought that was so sweet.
Yeah, he just takes photos of the backs of people's heads and then goes around giving it to people saying, I can help you see now. But I think that for me was like the crux of the film, like, and what the film does also in a way. We have a certain perception of life and we see it through one way or one lens, and this film really helps you to show the other side of it, of yes, you may be always questioning or doubting yourself with the choices you make, mm-hmm. but in the end, that's life and you can live with it and you should enjoy it for what it is. Because I think, as you said, it's very mundane every day. Although a lot of things happen like mm-hmm. they do in life, it still feels a part of life rather than anything sort of super dramatic or shocking.
Yeah.
I think he tries to show us that this will always happen and there's a cycle that we all go through, but it's also how we choose to look at it and how to interact with it. And I think that's how it changed me in a way, because you're always questioning what you're doing in life, but mm-hmm. this film sort of not only sort of affirms the feelings you have, but gives you another way of looking at it.
Yeah. Like, looking back is not always better. What I also loved is that there's a line in the movie when he's having a conversation and he goes, "You never live the same day twice." And I believe that's also the subtitle of the movie, the tagline of the movie. And then, for example, his wife and NJ's wife struggles with the fact that she feels like she's living every day the same day. Like, there's nothing going on in her life.
Yeah.
She doesn't know what to tell grandma.
Yeah.
She doesn't know what to talk about because she feels like she's always living the same day. And I think the juxtaposition between those two things, like, you might feel like you're always living the same day, but if you really pay attention to these little things, you are never living the same day twice. It doesn't exist. But yeah, the looking back thing, just like interweaving that thing of like, did I make the right decision? Going back to your first love, like, would I have been happier if I stayed with her, if I made that decision? Something we all struggle with in life sometimes, but you know, we only live in one timeline and you made the choices you did, and it's good to, at least I feel like this movie says, it's good to sit with that and make the best of what you can in this.
And I think the story is only half of it, of what makes it so beautiful. And the other half is the fact that the way it's shot is sort of still frames, very static shots. And the beauty of that, it really gives you the time to not only sit with the images, but to look, to explore the whole frame within it. And these characters aren't often moving. There's not often much action, or when there is, it's the camera's very static, so you see everything happening.
Yeah, it's often also in wide shots. Yeah. They're just kind of like standing around.
Yeah,
a lot of it's filmed through windows and mirrors, which creates these beautiful tapestries of like, they'll be in a car and it'll be shot from outside. So you see the city kind of passing through in the reflection of the window while they're having a conversation. It's all these like beautifully meditative kind of shots.
Yeah.
And like outside of a bagel shop or something, and you see the reflections in the windows and you see them having a conversation in the bagel shop, or a lot through mirrors as well. I thought it was a beautiful choice.
I think this was Edward Yang's final film. And I just love these films where you really feel the director is talking to you directly. Like, the characters are just a vessel for him to
say something.
So and there's a conversation between the daughter and a boy she's on a date with. And they're talking about film and cinema. And the boy is explaining how his uncle says that going to the cinema is like living three times, because watching films makes you live double the life that you could have.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that also captures so well what cinema is, or what, at least for me, why I love it, because it took your breath away. You couldn't like not take your eyes off it. It does feel long. I mean, normally when like a good film and it's 3 hours, you say like,
feel like 3 hours. Yeah. No, this felt like 3 hours, but in a good way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. It's very intentional, because by the end you watch time pass in a very similar way and you see how profound the lives that they have, but how simple and mundane it is at the same time. And wow, I'm definitely going to be going back to watch this film again.
Yeah, masterpiece for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, because it has 97% of Rotten Tomatoes. It won Best Director at Cannes. And yeah, as I said, it's often regarded as one of the best films of the 21st century. And now I finally know why. Okay, one battle after another.
Oh, shit.
This is what you came for.
Yeah.
One battle after another. Damn. Paul Thomas Anderson made an action movie. Do we need an action movie directed by PTA? Turns out, yes. The movie's loosely based on Thomas Pynchon's novel Vineland, and it kicks off with Leonardo DiCaprio and Tiana Taylor as part of a quite explosive revolutionary activist group called the French 75. Hot on their heels is Colonel Lockjaw, played by Sean Penn. He's a white supremacist, but he's also obsessed with Tiana Taylor. 16 years down the line, we see Leonardo and his 16-year-old daughter, played by Chase Infinity, dealing with the consequences of the French 75's actions. Here's a clip.
I don't know if you remember, but we spoke earlier on the phone. I think we had a little misunderstanding. I think we got off on the wrong foot. I was trying to get the rendezvous point for my daughter,
right,
Willa.
If you can't answer what time is it, I cannot give you the rendezvous point. This is a key tenet of the Rebellion. I'm surprised you can't name it. I don't know if you are who you say you are.
Laura.
Yeah, Elliot. One battle after another.
I think this film is the best film of 2025, maybe of the 2020s.
Damn, yeah.
I think, big claim to make, but I think...
No, I think you might be right.
Oh my gosh. So I had no expectations going in. Tom did mention that it was brilliant and he wasn't going to say anything more before, when he watched it. We got to see it in the IMAX, and because it's shot on VistaVision, it is one of the ways to go watch it. Me personally, I'm going to see it on IMAX, but also here at Lab as many times as I can.
Yeah.
Because this film, on the one side, is very political, and at the same time, it's not. And that's the beauty of it. And I think it tries to perfectly capture the times that we live in without commenting on the times that we live in.
Yeah.
I think it's a film that, because Thomas Pynchon's novel, Vineland, is set in the 1980s, and it's sort of a revolutionary group from the 1960s that were protesting the Vietnam War and other atrocities at that time, and sort of looking at the aftermath of what happens to a revolutionary group when they don't get their demands and how do they continue living. And Paul Thomas Anderson tries to transport this to the present day, and it shows you how timeless that thing is of, we continue to fight this one battle after another.
Yeah.
But how do we go on living in that way? How do we remain true to our principles that we want to live by? And as my man Vin Diesel always says, it's also always about family.
Family. Ohana. That's Ohana. Yeah. What I think is great about this movie, there's many things that I think are great, but I'm excited for it to do really well at the box office because I think it has enough appeal as an action movie to the regular action crowd.
Yes.
But it has enough PTA for the PTA heads, because I believe in initial test screenings about like a year ago, it wasn't received very well.
Yeah.
And I think it's one of those things where like PTA fans didn't really know what to make of, like, he's going to do a big scale action. Like, I think it's like a 200 million.
Yeah, 130
movie.
Million.
130 yeah. million action movie with Leonardo DiCaprio. How is this going to work? But I think it's such a masterclass in balancing that.
Yeah.
So, like, there's action, but the whole time from the get-go, you're invested in these characters and their motivations. And, oh, God, it's just so good. There's a car chase scene in this that's filmed unlike any car chase scene I've ever seen in my life. Because we were sitting next to each other, I was just looking at you like, what the hell is this? This is so neat. So it does have a lot of that like amazing filmmaking. Yeah. It has this insane like absurdist humor. Steven Spielberg hosted a Q&A and he compared it to Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah,
actually. And the tone of like, it's about serious things, but there's this like weird tone of humor to it.
Yeah, Sean Penn is hilarious this film. Yeah, he plays Colonel Lockjaw, and he's sort of like this sexually frustrated yet white supremacist guy who's in love with Perfidia, I believe her name is.
And Perfidia Beverly Hills. Yeah.
Great name.
Played by Tiana Taylor.
Apparently it's based off a Spanish song, Perfidia.
Oh.
That's where the character comes from. That's where I was listening to an interview. But with that car chase scene, I can't remember if you said it to me or I read it somewhere, but someone said it's probably the best car chase scene without seeing any cars actually overtake each other.
Right.
Because it's just these rolling hills and you see the suspense build. It's a brilliant film. And I think at the base of it, I think this is everything a film should be. Like trying in some ways to respond to the times we live in and the feelings that we're dealing with and make sense of that. But it also shows you can make a brilliant action film with heart, and it can be brilliant without having to do like, sorry for all the Mission Impossible fans, but just the same old stuff, but let's do crazier and crazier stunts
and let's do 1,000 flashbacks.
Maybe we can get into sort of the story a bit more. But so Leonardo DiCaprio, who is a ghetto Pat, so he goes from ghetto Pat to Bob, and he's part of the French 75, as you said, and he's known for his explosive knowledge, often detonating big fireworks as a distraction and celebration when they infiltrate sort of migration borders to release illegally held immigrants. And he then sort of has a baby with Perfidia and things happen. They have new identities and he's raising Willa by himself. And it's sort of him coming to terms with, like I said before, of he's sort of stuck very much in the past. He feels like his good days are behind him, but he has a duty to raise his daughter and becomes much more focused on her. But he becomes very paranoid also of mm-hmm. people still coming after him, but also the world not being safe for her to live in.
He's also a massive stoner Lebowski style. He's wearing a robe and he's smoking weed all the time.
He is, and he's watching Battle of Algiers in the middle of this on repeat, which I also find very funny. And then Colonel Lockjaw comes after him, again, for reasons we don't want to spoil too much. He is then chased, or him and his daughter are on the run and being chased. And the funny parts are when he's having to remember code words, but doesn't remember any of them because they're from 20 years ago. It shows this idea of how people who are once revolutionaries not able to live up to who they are now or something. And how also when he's on the phone to people who are part of the resistance efforts, not taking him seriously enough. And
don't you know who I am?
This disconnect. I did see a similar through line with Edward Yang Zhiyi of sort of connecting the past, present and future together in similar ways. I think there's a recognition that perhaps Bob's character didn't achieve what they set out to achieve. Mm-hmm. And again, is left to live sort of in exile almost in a very small town, and then putting all his hopes and future into his daughter, Willa, who perhaps has a more open mindset. She actually uses the right pronouns of her friends, unlike Bob and stuff, who, which is also, I found quite, again, captures really well. So Bob to us, perhaps, or to Gen Zs, would look quite backwards because he doesn't use the right pronouns. He's quite aggressive, all this kind of stuff. But really, he was fighting for the same things that we're fighting for today. Paul Thomas Anderson really captures that, those contradictions really well, but also that humor really well. Like, I couldn't stop laughing throughout the film as well.
Oh my God, it's so funny. And can I just say, Chase Infinity, the daughter, she plays 16, but she's actually 25 years old. But she looks 16, but she's incredible. I think it's her first movie. I think she's done a TV show before. She's absolutely incredible. I think it's insane for someone who's doing their first big movie to really hold their own with some of the biggest movie stars of all time.
Yeah.
I thought she was incredible. Couldn't look away. Big kudos to her. Also, Regina Hall, who plays a side character, she plays Deandra. Beautiful stuff from her. And also, I have to say it, and I've said it before on the internet, I hate when they make me like Leonardo DiCaprio.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. I think he's a fucking loser in real life, but he's one of the best actors we have, and I will admit when I'm wrong.
Yeah, so. It's annoying, because there's also, again, a certain irony that given his own political choices and his inability to live up to the things he claims he's fighting for instance, the climate crisis, that he's then this guy, Bob.
Yeah, well, just to give some context to that, because I posted about this on TikTok, and then a lot of men came out, was like, what's the problem with DiCaprio? Well, so there's obviously the girlfriend thing, you know, I think that doesn't have to be repeated. But then there's also the fact that he's now investing millions into building an eco hotel in Israel.
Yeah.
That's sinister. And there's just a lot of things about him. He went to Bezos' wedding. He loves private jets. And then he's like, I love the world. And it's like, why don't you do something for the fucking world? That and the girlfriends, because I think that's sinister as hell and diabolical.
Someone that we also need to give a shout out to is Benicio Del Toro, who plays Sensei. And again, what I loved about this is he was actually giving me Wes Anderson vibes.
Totally, because he's so,
But it works so well in this environment because not everybody else is the same sort of stilted kind of character. And so then there's this contrast that plays really well. It just makes me think of how, like, Paul Thomas Anderson is willing to sort of dip in and out of all these different genres and styles and mix them in such a cohesive way that I think other filmmakers are afraid to do or are very comfortable sticking to what they know.
Yeah.
And again, I think it's, is his name John Greenwood?
Johnny Greenwood. That was next up on my list. We got to give a big shout out to Johnny Greenwood. I wrote down in my stupid little notebook, it's like Johnny Greenwood is like another character in the movie.
He's the composer.
He's the composer. He's famously the guitarist in Radiohead.
Yes.
And he did great. He always does great. He's worked with Paul Thomas Anderson a lot. And I think his score here is very interesting because it does this thing where it's like almost like in Birdman, where it's like this constant kind of like tapping, but it has this like janky dissonant piano that's playing the whole time in the background, just giving you this constant feeling of unease.
Yeah. Often single keys as well. So like bling, 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 almost bling, like an alarm bling, bling. Or detonator about to go off. Yeah. You feel the tension. And then also whoever's doing the needle drop moments, oh my gosh,
Chef's kiss says it. Oh. You know how much I love Steely Dan? Steely Dan gets a needle drop and a mention.
There's so many.
5 stars. Yeah.
There's what, Ready or Not as well, comes in at the perfect time.
Yeah.
There's so much to talk about this film because it is brilliant. Not enough words for it. And I think this is a film we'll go on talking about for a long, long time.
Instant classic.
Yeah.
Also nearly 3 hours. So that's the theme.
I think I said to you after watching this film that I think PTA has probably now cemented himself as probably, at least in my mind, the greatest filmmaker of his generation.
I mean, to me, he was already there, but this was like, this really drove it home.
I think maybe he could be criticized, maybe the wrong word, but for not being able to make a big blockbuster film, but this is exactly it. And I think
he was just like, hold my beer. Yeah. Let me make the biggest, coolest blockbuster that we're going to be talking about for the next 40 years. But I highly recommend you go see it. It's playing right now at Lab and other places. The movie Him.
I am him.
I am him. We are all him. Are we? I don't know. Let's see. Him, loudly heralded to be produced by Jordan Peele, but no one seems to pay mind to who directed it, because that was not Jordan Peele. It's relative newcomer Justin Tipping, who so far has done, quote-unquote, over 20 episodes of TV, and the movie kicks, according to his website. We start the movie on a young boy whose father ensures him that one day he'll be as great as star quarterback Isaiah, played by Damon Wayans. Then we cut to him as a star player with huge potential. He suffers a head injury and takes the opportunity to take a week-long boot camp with Isaiah, the great one, to become the GOAT, the greatest of all time. Or will he? Here's a clip.
Just ain't no game. Just ain't no game, man. This is everything. You are not your father. Does Cameron Cade want this? Yes, I want this. Then what are you willing to sacrifice?
Everything!
I'm so sad. I had really high expectations for this film.
Me too.
The concept of it, I thought, was brilliant. But that's all it was. And I don't think it ever got out of the concept. Idea, and I just kept thinking to myself, oh, what would Jordan Peele do with this film?
But this is what I've been discussing with my friends. It's like, what does he see in this? And is he, because he hasn't been doing any promo, because which is not common for a producer to do promo, but like,
yeah,
I really feel like I don't know what happened here. Just to kind of like catch you up if you haven't seen it, which, because there was one other person in my screening yesterday anyway. It's this story, and he goes to this boot camp with Isaiah, who is the GOAT, the greatest of all time. He wants to be the GOAT. So he goes into this week-long training camp, and it's chaptered in 6 chapters. The first chapter is fun. Is there fun to be had? No. The second chapter is poise. Do we teach him anything about poise? No. Leadership, resilience, vision, and sacrifice. And none of these make sense with the thing that follows.
Yeah.
And I think the whole movie it's constantly like patting itself on the back for being so deep and being so mysterious and weird that I feel like its defendants will be like, you just didn't get it. And there's nothing to get.
No.
It's strung together by a slew of semi-deep quotes about what it takes to be the greatest. I had nothing before I had football. No guts, no glory. Real men make sacrifices. And it's like, I get what you're trying to do. You're trying to say that this is a toxic culture that's run by the elite, and they're sacrificing basically these boys and their entire lives, blah, 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 blah. We know. There was a quote, Elliot, I want you to help me make sense of this. Where Isaiah mysteriously in a sauna says to the guy whose name I don't remember. I saw it yesterday. And he says, you're starving to death in prison and someone offers you food or freedom. Do you really have a choice? Meaning like, of course you choose food. And I go, you choose freedom and then you get a fucking sandwich. This isn't as deep as you think it is. Like, he's doing all these like things. Also, Damon Wayans is delivering every line with, you can just see the thought in the back of his head going, this is going to be so fucking great.
Yeah.
I'm going to make a meal out of this. Like that. Oh my God. Anyway, I've been talking for 37 minutes. Please.
No, but there was no depth to Isaiah's character as well. Like there was certain moments where perhaps you could see him break or there was something underneath and the film never gave it a chance to go further into that. I think the connections it tries to draw between sport, religion, and how American culture in particular has sort of commercialized it to such an extent that they're basically stock or cattle being herded and raised is very important and relevant to talk about. And I think I'm all for it if films want to go down this route, but it doesn't go anything further. It's like, I didn't come out and learn anything different or new or open my eyes up. And I was also thinking like, how the trailer, not obviously you shouldn't base anything on off a trailer, but the trailer gave it a more horror vibe or something more thrilling. And I would like to have seen it gone a bit further down that route rather than anything else. Then it just became more commentary.
Yeah. So what I feel about the horror part is that it does horror in a way that is exhausting. So imagine this scene. Okay. So he's walking through this like big, like concrete, like brutalist hallway, and it's evening and it's dark, and he's walking through this hall down this hallway, and then behind him around the corner a football comes rolling up and he's like, what's this football doing here? And then he bends down to like pick it up and he has like a flash. It's a flash and it's all these mascots going wah! And then he's like, what was that? So it's that.
Yeah, it's that.
It doesn't do anything. And there's a lot of gore. There's a lot of like stabbing and ripping people apart and things like that. So it's gory. And it does these things where you go, okay, here comes the jump scare. Strap in.
Yeah.
And then it does that thing of like the mascots, because if you're not the goat, you're just a mascot is what they keep repeating. And it's like, yeah, I get it. It reminds me a lot. I don't know why I'm making her catch Therese for this, but it reminds me a lot of like Emerald Fennel in a way that like, it's just this thing that's like jerking itself off for how deep it is. And meanwhile, we're all sitting here is like, yeah, he killed all the people to get Saltburn, obviously. Yeah. And that's kind of what it's doing. It's like, wait, are you?
Perhaps this film does worse because it has the tagline produced by Jordan Peele.
Yes.
Because you have the expectation that, or at least for me, that, oh, maybe it's going to be similar to Get Out, where it builds to something that it's going to really reach a climax, but it just tells you everything straight from the start. Mm-hmm. And then it just explores that world. And it's like also shot in such an annoying, like classic kind of, I felt like I was watching like a sport commercial.
Music video, sports commercial. If you want to make a music video, make a music video. Like
I watched it with a friend and they said it best. It's like the boys version of Substance.
Yeah. Okay. I see.
Or Substance for the Boys.
Substance for the Boys, except the substance was fun. And this is the whole time I just, I don't know. Also, the boy Cameron in the movie, played by Tyreek Withers, he delivers every line with the spice of a bowl of oatmeal. It's truly just like, there's a scene where he has to throw the ball good. And if he doesn't throw the ball good, someone's going to get shit kicked in the face by whatever. And the way he responds to this is not with the appropriate amount of horror. It's just like, I wrote down a line that he said, what is happening? What's going on? And it's just, there's nothing to his performance that conveys the actual anxiety that you would have if you would find yourself in a situation like this. Also, Julia Fox, bless her little heart, not an actress.
But I thought it was perfect casting because she plays probably exactly who she is in real life.
That's true.
I was happy with that.
Then also we have comic relief coming from Tim Heidecker, who somehow signed on to this, and Jim Jeffries. Jim Jeffries is comic relief coming in with hilarious one-liners like, I work so hard I don't even see my kids. I don't have kids, but if I did, I wouldn't see them. And it's like, just not even a corner of my mouth could muster up. It's, oh man.
It tries. It really tries.
I don't feel it does. It feels like it's written by AI. The whole time I was thinking, this feels like it was written by AI.
Yeah.
It's
But we would be spoiled if it was three instant classics in a row to discuss.
Come on, that'd be too much.
Yeah.
So we need one steaming pile of horseshit in there. I think you're so right in saying that if this wasn't produced by Jordan Peele and led on every poster with size 140 font produced by Jordan Peele and somewhere as a footnote saying directed by Justin Tipping of the Peacock series, Joe versus Carol, the Tiger King spoof story, it wouldn't have had these insane expectations. I have to say, there are parts of it that look incredible for a sports commercial.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it never looks like a movie. It never feels like a movie. It constantly feels like, you know, remember like back in the 90s and 2000s, music videos would have like a 1 minute like little video before it, like setting up the story of the, that's what it felt like.
Yeah.
I just felt like at any point someone could like break out into song or rap.
Yeah.
And even that didn't happen. So it felt like a sneeze that never came. All three of these movies are now screening at Lab 111. You know where to get your tickets. It's at lab111.nl or in the show notes.
Stay connected with us at Celebrating Cinema and Lab by following at Lab111 on Instagram and Letterboxd. Do you love what we do? Support us by leaving a review on your favorite podcast platform. It really helps us climb the ranks of the podcast charts. This was a Lab 111 production, edited and produced by Elliot Bloom, with music from Hugo Emmertzall and artwork from Studio FFF.